Director from EPA Region 2 to provide a brief introduction. Stephanie, can you begin?
Sure. Thanks, Jean. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Stephanie Lampster, and I'm a member of EPA Region 2's RCRA Lead Region team. Thank you for participating in today's RCRA Expert Brown Bag webinar on long-term stewardship at corrective action sites. During this webinar, your hosts are going to discuss the approach to RCRA facilities subject to corrective actions being taken by Connecticut's Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. EPA Region 1 will start the webinar off with a brief overview of its regional approach to the LPS process and how it's worked to incorporate Connecticut's program into that process. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's presenters, Sebastian Rodriguez from EPA Region 1 and Sandy Brunelli and Diane Walworth-Duva from Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Sebastian Rodriguez started with EPA Region 1 in 2015 and currently serves as a remediation project manager overseeing cleanups under both the RCRA and TSCA programs. He has a Bachelor of Science in Natural Resource Management from Auburn University. Prior to working at EPA, Sebastian was a research technician for the U.S. Geological Survey. Sebastian chairs EPA's Long-Term Stewardship Practitioners Workgroup and is also active in EPA's data management and GIS communities. Sandy Brunelli started with Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, CTDEEP, in 1992 and currently serves as the state's Corrective Action Program Coordinator and Liaison with EPA Region 1. She has a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Earth Science from Eastern Connecticut State University. Prior to working at CTDEEP, Sandy worked as an environmental consultant conducting environmental site assessments, audits, and RCRA closures. Sandy has previously served on its Duwamish Corrective Action and Permitting Task Force. And Diane Walworth-Duva has worked with CTDEEP since 1992 and currently directs the Emergency Response Planning Office. She previously conducted field inspections, implemented RCRA enforcement actions, supervised RCRA corrective action, coordinated brownfields policies, developed materials management policies, and directed energy efficiency policies and programs for the agency. Diane graduated from Brown University and earned a master's degree in environmental management from Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Thank you, Sebastian, Sandy, and Diane for hosting today's webinar. At this time, I'd like to hand things over to Sebastian.
Hey, thanks, Stephanie. Sebastian Rodriguez here in Region 1. As she said, I'm a corrective action project manager here. Give me one second while the presentation loads. Okay, perfect. Can everyone see it?
Yes, we can.
Wonderful. All right, so I'll just hop right into it. I'm going to give a very high-level overview of our regional approach to RCRA corrective action long-term stewardship, just talk a little bit about our processes for handling the problem, how the metrics behind it, and then I'll hand it over to Connecticut for a little more in-depth discussion as to their stewardship permit. So it's always important to ask yourself why long-term stewardship. It's always good to bear this in mind during these kind of presentations. It's a good opportunity to consolidate and document the status of the site's investigation, remediation, and engineering and institutional controls. This information a lot of times will be found in remedial action plans and site investigation plans and a huge file. And it's a great long-term stewardship is a great opportunity to bring all that information into one place. Additionally, it's an opportunity to monitor existing controls into the future, make sure that institutional and engineered controls are being maintained as intended, and to ensure that the remedy remains protective for the long term. This is especially important with the discovery of new exposure pathways, like when vapor intrusion was brought to our attention years ago, and then also with things like emerging contaminants. So there are 296 RCRA sites on the 2020 list in New England. 167 of those are in Connecticut. So we have six states, and one of our states has over half of our sites. So they have quite a universe. On those 167 RCRA sites, EPA is aware of 117 engineered controls and 73 institutional controls. We came to those numbers through an in-depth file review for each individual site. So overall, EPA is aware of 113 sites out of Connecticut's 167 that have some kind of institutional control, engineered control, or a combination of both. which means that we need to consider them for long-term stewardship. So that's a pretty big number, and we've developed a regional approach to handling that, but we also work with our states to help to, so that they can help us perform these assessments. So our regional approach, we've developed a standardized long-term stewardship checklist. The goal of this checklist is to compile as much information on a site in a single place so that in the future somebody who doesn't have any involvement in the site can go to one place and have an idea of what the remedy was, what kind of controls are ongoing at the site, what's at the site currently, and whether or not EPA or the state thinks that those controls will remain protective for the long term. So we combine this checklist process involves both a file review prior to going out on the site, along with an in-person boots on the ground assessment. So prior to going on the site, we'll go through the file, read about some of the controls in place, find out about the remedy in the site history, and we'll log any additional controls that we find during the file review in RCRA info if we didn't flag them originally. And then we'll go out, make sure that the institutional controls are being maintained as intended and engineer controls as well, find out any new uses of the property, and determine if additional steps are needed in the remedy to make sure that it remains protective in light of new information. We've been doing this for about 4 or 5 years, but we've been intending to incorporate this into our regional approach on a long term. So we'll be moving in this direction much more moving forward. In addition to filling out this checklist, we also use the opportunity to update our other information systems. A lot of critical documents that we only have in paper, such as land use restrictions, are scanned and made available online in our SEMS document management system. We map out the geographic location of controls and put that information in the Cleanups in My Community web viewer and also in a regional web map. And we also make notes about the current site use and incorporate that in our checklist. So once the final checklist is done, it should provide a summary of the site as a snapshot in time with up-to-date information. As attachments, we'll include the copies of the land use restriction documents, any notes that we may have made, anything that we want the file to have, and then we'll provide that to the facility owner and to the record as a final record. So this is a very useful process, we found, but it's also very intensive. And given the way regional resources are, we need to work with our states to help share the long-term stewardship workload to make sure that all of these sites can get the attention that they need. So we're looking for ways to leverage existing state mechanisms to provide for long-term oversight, which is why we're so excited about the Connecticut Deep Stewardship Permit. It fits in. It provides an enforceable mechanism for ensuring that institutional engineering controls are maintained, and it provides for investigation or remediation. And it also can complement our regional long-term stewardship checklist. It allows for information to be shared between the two different forms, and it provides a facility an idea of what kind of remaining long-term stewardship obligations need to be kept in mind. So that's how we've worked with Connecticut with their long-term stewardship permit, and how it's paired in nicely with our program. Now I'm going to hand it over to Sandy Brunelli, who's the RCRA Corrective Action Coordinator out there at DEEP, and she's going to talk a little more about the stewardship permit, maybe about the history of the program and the benefit that it has for both regulators and for the regulated community. So, Sandy?
Hi, thanks a lot, Sebastian. Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about Connecticut's industrial history and how our corrective action universe got so big and what our vision is for the long-term stewardship program. And then finally, Diane's going to talk a little bit about how the stewardship permit fits into the long-term stewardship vision and what the mechanics of the program are. So Connecticut has a long industrial history. In particular, we have a lot of metal finishing specialty shops. And it's mainly due to the presence of bigger manufacturing and aerospace companies like Pratt & Whitney, Stratford Army Engine Plant, Sikorsky, Hamilton Standard, who were major drivers in attracting smaller specialty companies who had metal finishing and plating operations. And these companies, they all set up shop along the rivers and discharge their waste into the water bodies. So in order to stop that contamination into the water, Connecticut wrote its own Clean Water Act in 1967. And then in 1972, the Federal Clean Water Act was passed, using Connecticut as an example. We stopped everyone from discharging industrial waste into the water, but the solution was to move it onto the land. And that is how we ended up with a lot of record lagoons, impoundments, and drying beds. When you add together our early industrial legacy and our early Clean Water Act, it means we have a lot of land disposal facilities. I'll talk a little bit about that in the next coming slides. But I should also mention that besides aircraft-related products, there are also a lot of other things that are made in Connecticut, such as blenders and typewriters, razors, Stanley. We have tools and hardware, hats, circuit boards, and clocks. And we are also the home of Pez candy, but you won't find them on any of our lists. So like Sebastian mentioned, this chart shows the 2020 TSDFs by region. And you can see that more than half of the TSDFs in Connecticut are in Connecticut as part of Region 1. In fact, we're actually the fifth highest count in the country. And if you want to break that down a little bit more, you can see we have over 100 land disposal facilities. So instead of writing an order for each facility, we actually wrote a regulation that triggers corrective action for the land disposal facilities. We designed the regulation to coordinate with our other state remedial programs to create a one cleanup program, which allows facilities to conduct investigation and cleanup one time, but get credit under multiple programs so that they don't have to do duplicate work. We also had to incorporate a few specific federal corrective action requirements, including public participation, 400 ppm criteria for lead, submittal of a QAP, and the requirement to conduct an ecological risk assessment. We established the regulation by coordinating with EPA and worked it into our authorization package. But today the reality is that the majority of these facilities no longer need an operating permit, but they do need to conduct site-wide corrective action. So unless they can walk away without controls, some type of long-term stewardship is needed. It's going to be needed for the land disposal facilities that will require post-closure care, as well as sites with engineered and institutional controls or long-term responsibilities. And while Connecticut and EPA prefer permanent remedies and restoration, sites need to remediate up to the cleanup standards that are risk-based. For example, this site on this slide is Exide Corporation in Fairfield, Connecticut. They made automotive batteries for 30 years. And as a result of their activities, they contaminated soil and groundwater and sediment. Their primary constituents of concern were lead, TPH, and PCBs. So they started cleaning up the site in the 1990s, but the bulk of the cleanup began in about 2005. It included demolition of all the buildings on site and excavation of approximately 44,000 tons of contaminated soil. They also conducted several ecological evaluations and risk assessments that resulted in dredging and disposal of approximately an additional 27,000 cubic yards of lead impacted sediment. This was a really huge project for us, and kudos to the project manager. The remedies that they implemented attained cleanup standards that satisfied both the state and EPA. The sediment removal met site-specific ecological risk-based criterion determined through extensive ecological assessment work. And this site also had a lot of public involvement. It was organized through a local advocacy group, and there was a lot of interaction with the town of Fairfield representatives. It was sometimes contentious, but in the end, by the end of the cleanup, through time and patience, there was a special bond that brought them all together, and I was there for the final meeting, and I saw it. In January 2020, just recently, after post-remedial groundwater monitoring was completed, and they were able to demonstrate that the risk-based criteria were met, the department engaged in the public participation process before making a final decision to deny the permit, since remediation was complete and no permit was needed, and allow the facility to exit RCRA by terminating interim status. So this property is now ready for reuse without controls, and we have issued them a certificate of completion. But unfortunately, not all cleanups result in unrestricted use. But we can achieve cleanup with cleanup complete with controls. For example, in the case of this landfill, the caps need to be monitored and maintained, a land use restriction needs to be in place, groundwater monitoring needs to be conducted, and site security needs to be maintained. It took a long time for industrial waste to leave their mark. It's going to take a long time for cleanups to reach completion. In fact, some will need stewardship, long-term stewardship, for a very long time. So even though completion without controls is ideal, how do we ensure completion with controls is just as effective? Well, we have a vision. Not 1,000 points of light, but our vision for long-term stewardship is finding a way to keep our promise to the future by documenting remedies that are effective and protecting human health and the environment. And we want to remove uncertainty on the path to cleanup. And because ownership of these properties may change hands over time, we want to make sure that transfer is as simple as possible. So, as I mentioned, the facilities that have long-term responsibilities, outstanding work to complete, or rely on controls to be protective will need a stewardship permit. The permit keeps track of the ongoing work and memorializes it for the current and future owner, the public, and the agencies. And it's enforceable, ensures that the permittee follows through with the work needed. The permit can be used to address many different issues. For example, we've used it in several cases to work with the company to allow us to recognize them and their cooperation while they clean up, but and work with them to put together a schedule that meets the needs of the facility and keeps the progress moving forward. Or if a company needs to secure funding, they can show the permit to the bank to demonstrate that the department is on board with and in fact requires that the expensive work they're about to complete, that they're committed to do that work. And it's also a good tool. We have a couple of sites that are close to being abandoned to get them started on the road to cleanup to make sure that there's a responsible party there. In addition, it can also be used to advance redevelopment by allowing parceling off of areas that can be verified to meet cleanup criteria without controls, but are now ready for anticipated use. Our universe has sites that are in various stages of investigation, remediation, or health controls or long-term care. So Connecticut uses a stewardship permit as a mechanism to ensure long-term stewardship. Now I'm going to turn it over to Diane Duba, who was instrumental in Connecticut's authorization and the development of stewardship permit. And she's going to talk a little bit about the mechanics and the permit essentials, and she's going to explain how Connecticut uses stewardship permits to manage long-term stewardship obligations. Diane?
Thank you, Sandy. I really hope that all of you listening in today are thinking hard about what works for you in your state, because the tools that we're using are available to everybody with corrective action delegation and authorization. And the main vehicle we're talking about today is the stewardship permit, because the permitting authority is such a critical fundamental part of a state's authorization for a corrective action program. And stewardship permits in particular consolidate the long-term obligations for a facility, or link together, as I've said here. And what I mean by linking them together is that the permit essentially brings together the opportunity for meaningful public participation at various stages of the cleanup to advance community acceptance of the long-term management of the property. That's a very important part of any permit, whether it's an operating permit or a cleanup permit, and it's also, of course, very important for the remedial process. We ensure that meaningful public participation occurs potentially for multiple reasons, for other cleanup programs that a facility may be also enrolled in, as well as RIF or corrective action. But we use the permit to consolidate the obligations. The permit also provides a memorialization of the obligations that engineered controls or institutional controls may be used to balance out what's needed to ensure that the remedy remains effective. And permits are grounded in the establishment of financial assurance
for the cost of performing the activities that are specified in the permit that aren't yet completed, and for the long-term post-closure care, maybe it's groundwater monitoring or maintenance of a control that needs financial assurance. A permit schedule can be used to balance the current cleanup costs with phased-in financial assurance obligations. So as Sandy has said, you know, the best thing is for cleanup to occur and be completed with everybody able to walk away and be able to not have to question whether or not the cleanup was complete. That's the best thing. But the next best thing is to say what is needed to be done, because permits really do a couple of great functions. They institutionalize information about what's been done in the past, and they also communicate what needs to happen in the future. So it's an important tool to document or create a historic record of what's already been done while the people who know what happened are still around, and this can be memorialized so that as people come and go, whether it's the owners or the regulators or the consultants that are working on the property, it's an important way to create that historic record. And the compliance schedule can specify time frames to spell out what work needs to be completed. And doing this reduces uncertainty for a lot of people. It removes uncertainty, most importantly, for the current and future owners regarding the requirements for closure, post-closure care, corrective action, monitoring, et cetera. And what's really nice about that is that it clarifies to land investors and developers, banks and insurance underwriters that it is okay that an environmental remedy may use a schedule to complete the remediation if it's not yet done, and that it's okay to use engineering controls and institutional controls to maintain effective remediation. Because these permits are about how we believe that the remedy is going to remain effective into the future. And that's important because the community may question why waste is being left in place or why residual contamination has to remain, because it may take a while for it to get down to a lower level. But when there's a permit in place, it's a way to communicate that both the agency and the property owners and operators are committed to keeping promises that a remedy will remain protective of human health and the environment even into the future. So now just a quick review of some of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act specifics. The 1984 Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments required corrective action for releases from facilities, whether they're from regulated units or from other areas of concern. So remember that RCRA is the Superfund prevention law and was intended to ensure that facilities who want to treat, store, or dispose of hazardous waste take care of the history of releases that may have occurred prior to the regulation of how wastes are treated, stored, disposed, and including how generated waste is managed. So the idea is that with RCRA in place, we'd have fewer releases in the future. However, because of releases prior to RCRA's promulgation, it's important to clean up so we have a clean slate going forward. And then in 1998, EPA's post-closure rule said, you know, corrective action and closure and post-closure care requirements are so similar on the same facility that it's important for states to be able to coordinate those cleanups. And this means that a facility's need for a post-closure permit can take the form of an alternate enforceable document, as long as it defines the outstanding obligations. So there's a few different things that these are called. They can be called a HISWA, or Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments Permit, or a Corrective Action Permit. We might have RCRA Post-Closure Part B permits. Another state may want to have some sort of a stewardship agreement. Our legal counsel advised us to use the word permit in the title as a way to communicate to a future judge if we were ever in court enforcing the permit. Our legal counsel wisely said it would be much easier to communicate to that judge that this is, in fact, a permit and any violations of it are quickly able to be enforced. But regardless of what it's called, each is a name for a RCRA permit that describes closure, post-closure care, RCRA corrective action, site-wide, and or monitoring obligations for facilities that have managed hazardous waste. post-closure permits require these things. The citation is there. Importantly, permits, it's mentioned in the regulations that anything that has not been completed, any corrective action that hasn't been completed by the time of permit issuance, needs to have a schedule of compliance included in the permit at the time of permit issuance. Now, the fact that a permit is not needed or denied for the active operations of a hazardous waste management facility managing process waste doesn't affect the requirement to obtain a post-closure permit or an equivalent enforceable document. Again, we have operating permits and we have the HISWER corrective action or RCRA post-closure permit. They may be one and the same if you have an operating facility, or as is the case of Connecticut with our long legacy of industrial facilities that have since stopped operating, they actually allow a permit to be issued but for the non-operating portion of the obligations, meaning just the cleanup obligations. And again, just to review some basics of how Connecticut structured our permits, we've kept it super simple. We have our Section 1, which the attorneys write up and make sure that the document looks like a permit and sounds like a permit and walks and talks like a permit, and that means it's got all that standard boilerplate, and we really don't mess around with it from permit to permit. We just leave it alone, and that's the way we communicate that it's a permit, and it has all the compelling things about what our regulatory authority is to issue these requirements and to compel compliance. And then we get a little more fun in Section 2, where we get more specific about this particular facility and what where it is on its journey through the cleanup process. So a property might need some investigation to be started or finished if it's already far along in the process. It may have obligations to clean up even though the investigation's been done. I might say that you're going to need to install and maintain engineered controls as part of the remedy, and it may require the application of institutional controls. Essentially, this is the part that is saying you're a facility that has an obligation to do closure or post-closure care or site-wide corrective action. So essentially, we're saying we're giving you permission to do your job to clean up. And this is an important thing to remember, because when communicating with the public, or even with consultants or attorneys who are questioning why a facility needs a permit, well, the answer is we're simply communicating to the public that the agency is granting you permission to do what you need to do to be a good steward of this property. That's all that we're granting you permission for, facility, and to the public. We're not authorizing the receipt of hazardous waste from other facilities. We're not authorizing the management of process waste. We're simply permitting the facility to complete its obligations. And then the third part is the most fun part, because it's the to-do list or the punch list for any unfinished business. So it can be a super short list, it can be a super long list. We have a facility that was a nuclear power generation plant, the Connecticut Yankee Atomic Power Plant. And by the time we got to the point where we said they needed a permit issued, they'd actually done a whole lot of cleanup. The only thing they had left to do was groundwater monitoring. But in order to properly communicate to the community where they were in their journey, we issued the stewardship permit to spell out and document all of the magnificent work that had already taken place and identify that just the post-remediation groundwater monitoring necessary to comply with Connecticut's remediation standard regulations was needed. And in fact, after that permit was issued and the post-remediation monitoring period for that groundwater concluded, we actually then ended the permit. The other thing the schedule of compliance can do is provide some schedule for phasing and financial assurance. Now, obviously, a state could require all of it up front, but there's some good EPA guidance about establishing financial assurance. And one of the things it does is recognize that sometimes it's hard to figure out the cost estimate for work that hasn't yet been scoped out, and therefore you might need to incrementally require financial assurance as more information is available. Or alternately, you may want to create an incentive to a facility to either get started or speed up their cleanup by saying, as time goes by, more financial assurance will be required, which provides an incentive to put the money towards the cleanup now, because the more that gets done, the less financial assurance will be needed later. And then the scheduled compliance can spell out when public participation in the remedy and the determination that remediation is complete. When and how is that going to happen? If you have a facility that has a whole lot of energy in the community around the property, it may be a good way to channel that energy and spell out whether or not the community public participation process is going to occur in a way that includes active participation and discussion in forums, or whether there's other methods of community participation that's going to occur. But that can be spelled out in a schedule of compliance that is easy to update and modify down the road. And then the appendices are a great way to memorialize what's already been done. For example, we include a list of the areas of concern or solid waste management units that have been identified and addressed. And it's really fun to have a checklist at the end or a column at the end that says status for all those ones that are actually done. And that's very helpful. So just to quickly review some of the things that Sandy identified, there's different types of facilities where permits can be used. It might be hazardous waste land disposal facilities. It's pretty obvious they need permits because the waste or residual contamination is going to remain in place. There's hazardous waste. It's been disposed of to the ground. Of course, you need a guidebook for how you're going to be a good long-term steward of that property. But it can also be used to trigger investigation and cleanup at a treatment or storage facility that has the outstanding obligation to complete remediation because they have entered interim status and they submitted that Part A application, but they haven't just gotten around to going forward with getting corrective action done before the time of permit issuance. So that can help move things forward. And it can also be used in place of enforcement. It can be offered as a choice to a facility that's been maybe slow to achieve its interim milestones. And then there's, of course, hazardous waste treatment and storage facilities that end up with long-term stewardship controls that are needed to maintain the effectiveness of the property-wide remediation. So Sebastian provided a nice overview of this great tool that EPA is using to help, and one of the most important things that it helps with is getting things into the electronic universe in addition to the RCRA information system. It provides access to some of the documents that we're talking about in an electronic format, which is really wonderful. But then even more importantly is the checklist really triggers a good opportunity to meet in the field, to look at the sites, to go through the actual documents related to those sites, such as the environmental land use restrictions or information about engineered controls that need to be in place. And it prompts the state and EPA to get together. And it also can happen either by EPA or the state, as Sebastian pointed out. And as he pointed out, documenting in electronic format is going to be very useful for our future record keeping. So Connecticut, we really appreciate the coordination and assistance that EPA provides by ground truthing information about properties that require long-term stewardship. We think that's really going to be helpful going forward. Now, how do you transfer a permitted facility? Well, it's all spelled out right there in the regulations, how you transfer a permit. And there are, of course, obligations to notify the agency and to make a Class 1 modification with the written approval of the agency. But the permit transfer process is really something that can reduce regulatory uncertainty for facilities that are transferring operational control or transferring ownership, because the permit lays out the remaining regulatory work. And by contrast, a facility that's been issued an order, it opens up the possibility that the new property owner or operator would need to have an enforcement action issued. And that may not make sense to a property owner who's looking to invest in a facility, but they're not planning to continue to operate the facility, or they're going to change the industrial type of the facility or any or the commercial type or whatever. This allows the next owner to simply receive a permit or to receive that permission to carry forward. And facilities can negotiate with those future owners regarding who's going to pay for unfinished investigation or remediation. They can review the to-do list, schedule of compliance, during the permit transfer process. I thought I'd share a few pro tips about RCRA permitting. Of course, a lot of you in other states have issued a lot of operating permits and probably a lot of corrective action permits. But one of the things that we've learned is that there's a lot of opportunities for us to make this a positive experience. And one of those ways of doing that is to really understand what the existing environmental needs are for the property, but also to coordinate with the facility's business needs. So some of the questions we ask ourselves and ask the facility is, you know, what are your timing constraints? Is there someone at the current owner or a current owner or operator who's planning to retire or pass on a business to their family? Or is there an imminent auction that a federal agency wants to have take place for a property? What are the timing constraints? And is there an opportunity to issue the permit so that we get everybody's questions on the table at the right time? So we do ask facilities about ownership transfer plans, and we may want to anticipate plans to separate or combine parcels now or in the future. Sandy had touched on the idea that you can separate parcels and have one portion that's fully cleaned up without controls be essentially parceled off while the the portion that does have more work needs to continue. But having that permit in place makes sure that we don't have a situation where the good part of the property goes off and strands the other portion of the property that still has a lot more work to be done. We keep the permit obligations identifying what still needs to be done. And when you're working with a facility owner or operator, you want to agree on a schedule that makes sense, that essentially recognizes that some information may take a while to get. You want to set clear expectations for the future. And most importantly, I think a lot of people can appreciate it's so important to document decisions. They don't have to be revisited if the cleanup process outlasts the regulator's assignment or the property owner or the consultant assigned to it. And if you need to, you can always revise the schedule. So it's just a good opportunity to get everyone talking. Now let's pause for a moment. We're almost done here, and I just want to make sure we take a moment to recognize that, you know, if all the cleanup work is done and no permit is needed, get out of RCRA. Just exit. Do the work that's necessary to document that remediation is complete, all units have been closed, whether through a separate closure action or as part of the site-wide corrective action, and make sure that public participation in the proposed determination that the remediation is complete, make sure that that's done, and document that that cleanup is complete without controls. And if you really don't need any other controls and there's no other permit needed for operating or for any further work, then, you know, fill out that RCRA CA 999 and say you're done, and terminate the interim status. And the citation for that is on the slide there. Based on remediation completion, the agency will terminate interim status in this funny way, and EPA has good guidance about this. And you'll need to say that no permit is needed, therefore the permit is being denied. But it's an opportunity, and the reason why we issue these celebratory certificates, it's an opportunity to certify that someone has completed all their work. So these are examples of documents that we use literally just for the fun and celebration of it, where we award a certificate to a facility who has completed the obligations of their RCRA cleanup. We say that they've met the requirements of Connecticut, Connecticut's regulations, federal regulations, and have met our remediation standard regulations and other cleanup programs that we have. We make it clear this is one cleanup program, as EPA and the state has envisioned, and that this property is truly complete. And one of my favorite things was the day I got a phone call from someone years and years after a property had been cleaned up, and the fellow on the other end of the line was a banker, and he said, "Is this site cleaned up?" And I said, "What are you looking at? What type of paper are you looking at?" He says, "Well, I'm reading it. It says certificate of completion." I said, "Read a couple more lines." He read a couple more lines. I said, "Oh, yeah, that's right. That property is complete." He said, "Is there anything else that we need to do here to make sure it has no environmental obligations?" I said, "Nope, that property is done. And he said, "Okay, that's great. I'm going to process the loan." Hung up the phone. And I thought, wow, he didn't do a file review. He just read that piece of paper. So I thought it was just a fun thing to do. But we also award certificates of stewardship to our properties who have made that commitment through the permit issuance to complete any outstanding obligations to complete investigation and cleanup, and then to be a steward of the environment into the future by maintaining engineered controls, institutional controls, any post-remediation monitoring. And we think they should have an ability to simply communicate to their bankers and insurance underwriters and future property owners that we believe that they're, by participating in advancing their stewardship permit, that they are truly being a good steward of the property and that they deserve something to hang on the wall. So in summary, stewardship permits define the unfinished investigation and remediation work, as well as the long-term obligations. And even though completion without controls is best, the next best thing is to get it down in writing what those long-term obligations are and get them defined and really spell out how a stewardship permit protects human health and the environment. And it defines those long-term obligations. Even if the permit holder plans to sell the property as soon as possible, at least the facts are on the table for potential purchasers. And it makes sure the work gets done on a schedule that can be enforced if needed. No one needs to guess about what the state is going to require, if EPA will second-guess the state, or when the RCRA permit order will eventually be issued. And we can communicate the facility status to banks and insurance writers. The permits also provide public participation in cleanup and can direct community energy through a constructive channel and clarify a community's role in the cleanup design and acceptance. Again, what's most important is it documents that cleanup has been completed, whether it's in portions that can be declared done and then finance the next portion's cleanup, or if it's the entire property. And it imposes, perhaps through phasing in, financial assurance obligation, so that years from now, we'll be glad the money is there if work remains. Because as I mentioned, RCRA is the Superfund prevention law. And if the government is going to have the patience and tolerance to permit engineered and institutional controls to be part of the remedy rather than a walkaway cleanup, then we need some tools to be able to be patient and tolerant. And those tools really do come down to the financial assurance. And we have used the financial assurance when needed. So all in all, we're really proud of Connecticut's industrial legacy. As the EPA administrator and former DEP commissioner Gina McCarthy once said, the industrial revolution left the sweat stains on New England, and we're now cleaning them up. And we're happy and proud of our industrial history in our state, and our facilities that are cleaning up today are promoting and improving our economy as well as our environment. However, having a permit that puts down in writing what everybody needs to do is one of the most effective ways we think we can continue to protect human health and the environment during the cleanup and as part of the long-term stewardship of properties throughout our state. We're happy to answer any questions. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you so very much, ladies. We're going to move on to our Q&A portion for today's session. And I wanted to remind the audience that we do have that Q&A window available in the lower right corner of your screen to type them in. So we'll try to get through as many questions as we can in the time that we have. So I believe, Sebastian, I'm going to start with a question for you. This first question asks, is the EPA Region 1 LTS checklist accepted by other regions and the EPA in general?
So I know that other regions have modified our checklist slightly for use in their regions. It's not accepted nationally yet, just because I think there a lot of regions are at different stages in their development of their long-term stewardship programs, but it has been used by other regions, yes.
Okay, excellent, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and move on to some questions directed for our state speakers from Connecticut. So this first question just comments that in Michigan, we have, quote, corrective action long-term agreements, or CALTAs, as the LTS enforceable mechanism. They wanted to know, is the advantage of using a permit is that it has to be periodically renewed?
Oh, that's a great question. And Michigan, I just want to say, I wanted to call it a long-term stewardship agreement, and our attorney advised us to put that word permit in there. And as I always say to our attorney, well, he's usually always right in the long run, so we went with it. But I think your long-term agreement is probably just fine. But I think there is an advantage, you're right. to a permit that essentially has built-in review. So every RCRA permit has a cap in the federal regulations of 10 years. And ironically, we all thought, well, we'd make it as long as we could, but we have to put it as 10 years. But thank goodness it's at least 10 years. But some of us who issued those permits 10 years ago are saying, already? 10 years already? So it is, I think, it is an advantage to have a built-in compulsion to take a look at it, make sure that the requirements are up to date. It gives another opportunity to update where things are in the process to, again, memorialize while project managers and facility managers and consultants who are familiar with early parts of the cleanup, while they can remember what's going on, it allows them to say, here's where each individual area of concern is in its cleanup process. So I do think it's an advantage. I think that if you don't have an automatic review built in, you could always put that in a long-term stewardship agreement. It's sort of like in CERCLA, where there's, you know, the five-year review periods and things like that. But we also think a permit is easy to transfer because you don't have to renegotiate the terms of an agreement with a permit transfer. The permit itself is transferred. So while I think a long-term agreement is a great idea, there are those two advantages to permits, the ease of transfer and the fact that there's a built-in review at the time of the permit compliance period.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the LTS permit and the post-closure permit?
So this is Sandy. We call all of our permits stewardship permits, whether it's used for post-closure or for long-term obligations or for just RCRA closure or corrective action. So we refer to everything as we have this blanket of stewardship permits, but the long-term stewardship the stewardship permit is the tool that we use to ensure long-term stewardship for Connecticut.
It actually
can tailor it to address post-closure issues, or we can tailor it to address whatever the situation or outstanding obligations at the site is.
All right. We had another question asking if you would issue a stewardship permit if a facility only needed to maintain institutional controls and they did not need to perform any corrective action or post-closure care or long-term monitoring.
So that's a question that would, I think, very much invite conversation between a state and its EPA region, because there may be opportunities for not needing a permit for some very specific, simple institutional controls. So there's great guidance on this. Obviously, most people are probably familiar with EPA guidance on completion with and without controls. And we have reviewed that guidance, and we continue to review it with EPA. But there may be a very simple institutional control, such as, this is the best example, probably a residential cleanup has one standard, but an industrial commercial cleanup has another standard in our state for the blowing of the wind direct exposure standard for soil cleanup. And so we might have an institutional control as part of our cleanup regulations that say, you know, this property is cleaned up to industrial commercial standards, but you can't convert it to residential without doing further cleanup. However, you know, you have a bit of a safety net because you have zoning and land use changes that there's going to be some information about that made known when a property shifts gears. And so we might say in that case, we might discuss with EPA and say, do you think, you know, it's possible that we simply rely on our enforceable state cleanup regulations that say that institutional control needs to remain in place, and that if there was a change in that from industrial, commercial to residential, that probably means someone's around doing that development. So the need for financial assurance is not as great because there's someone actively doing something and violating that institutional control that the state could pursue and say, hey, you know, in order to continue to comply with the regulations, you need to do some additional cleanup to ensure that residential quality is met. So that's such a low risk to the government that we believe that's a situation where you wouldn't need to issue a permit, though I think the full question is a state and EPA should clarify those expectations as part of that discussion.
Okay, thank you. And I will try to get through a couple more questions. We are running a bit short on time, but let's see if we can go through this one. Just very quickly, can the Connecticut LTS permit also be used at brownfields and Superfund sites?
Yes, it's one cleanup program.
All right, excellent. And then another question, kind of going back to that idea of renewing the permit, how exactly do you renew your expiring permits? Does the responsible party ever decline when you try to renew those permits?
So we haven't had anybody actually decline, and if they chose to decline, then I guess we'd have to move forward with some type of additional enforcement on it. But they actually go through the same process they did when they applied originally. So there's a public notice of the application coming in. The application would come in. We would do a review of that, and then we would most likely take the old permit and then make sure that it was up to date. And then we would have to, at the end of that process, go through another public notice of tentative determination and do another public participation. And then we would make our final determination and reissue the permit.
And the permit can be bundled with other agency permit transfers. So there may be other parts of our agency that also need to transfer permits. So like many states, I mentioned, we have a permit ombudsman's office, and they'll bundle together all of those things and do that and help with the transfer process.
Okay, thank you. I also have a question in here about environmental trusts. So one of the attendees wanted to know if you've done any work with environmental trusts that have been set up to handle legacy waste. And they're specifically looking to see who would be included as a permittee in a case where the trust was meant to end after the remediation has been completed, where they're going to go on to do industrial use with waste left in place.
So it sounds like that might be essentially the trust is put into place to be, if not the owner, then an operator of a facility because there's no one else to take responsibility for it. Mm-hmm. So I think the situation there is that operator, you know, the trust can be the operator and can get the cleanup to whatever that next phase is and continue to either be the permit holder and try to market the property in its cleaned up state to someone else, and the permit would help specify what still remains to be done. Does that answer the question, do you think?
I think so, and if not, they're certainly welcome to share some clarifying response in the Q&A window, and if we have time, I'll bring it back up. So I do have a couple of comments in here asking about environmental covenants. So people want to know, first of all, do you do those? And how are they exactly integrated with stewardship permits?
So we absolutely include them. So Connecticut has had environmental land use restrictions for quite some time, and the UECA, or Environmental Uniform Covenants Act, actually looked at Connecticut's and Colorado's environmental land use restrictions because we've had them for a long time. So they essentially are referenced. It's not that there's one or the other. They're not competing with each other. The covenant or the land use restriction is incorporated into the permit in the sense that the permit is simply asking the question, how are you going to get this site cleaned up in compliance with state and federal regulations? And how are you going to ensure, if you rely on an institutional control like an environmental covenant, how are you going to maintain it into the future? And so we simply say, if you need a land use restriction to comply with cleanup standards, then you need to put it into place and maintain it and not violate it. So we're not redoing the covenant or land use restriction. We're simply pointing to it and integrating it into the overarching permit.
All right, fabulous. Thank you. We are reaching right to that scheduled closing time of 2 p.m. Eastern. So just in the interest of everyone's schedule, I'm going to close out the live Q&A period today, and we'll move on to some of our closing reminders. But before I do that, I wanted to thank all of our presenters, Sebastian, Sandy, and Diane, for taking time out of their schedules to share their expertise. along with the over 150 individuals who joined us for today's broadcast. Before we close things out today, I just wanted to cover a couple of quick reminders for today's session. First of all, EPA is looking for other programs to highlight with their LTS work in future RCRA Expert Brown Bags. So if you are interested in helping provide or offer presentations, something like the ones that you saw today, please feel free to reach out to Don Linegar or Charlotte Mooney. Their contact information can be found on the screen. You can also email me, ballant.gene@epa.gov, and I'll be more than happy to forward your information on. The group also wanted me to be sure to highlight that there is registration open for the upcoming ETSWAMO 2020 RCRA Corrective Action Conference, which will be taking place in June 3rd through the 5th, 2020, in Lexington, Kentucky. This conference will feature the theme of RCRA Corrective Action 2020 and the Road Ahead. So on their website, they have a draft agenda, and they'll also be covering a variety of topics with focuses on long-term stewardship. So again, since it's very relevant to our topic, we wanted to be sure everybody knows that registration for that event is now open. I will remind everybody that if you're interested in future webinars, you may want to check us out at cluin.org or sign up for our future monthly newsletters, TechDirect, which goes out on the first of each month. For those of you looking for copies of the presentation content, we already have those posted on the seminar homepage. You'll find it on the Resources or Links tab. So we've got links to that already available on the middle right of your screen under related URLs. Just one quick note, there was an LTS checklist up there. I do understand that the link is not working. I appreciate those of you who reached out to let me know. We'll get that link corrected today, but in the interim, you can also reach out to Sebastian Rodriguez from EPA Region 1, and he should be able to provide you with a copy of that checklist. But we will get the link fixed, and I'll be sure to email everyone once it's available. If you're looking for future information, pardon me, about our presenters, as you saw, it was contained at the end of their slides. We also have it posted on that seminar homepage. If you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, those links should work for you on the middle right under related URLs. I'll ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let me know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the tool that we used to deliver it as well as the content that was covered. Please know that I do read each and every one of those submissions, and the teams who helped organize the session will also browse through your feedback, so we really do value your input for future sessions. One of the most common questions that I get is if we offer seminar certificates, and we will provide you with one as long as you fill out that feedback form. But when you're filling out that form, please be sure to correctly enter your own email address and make sure you check the box at the very bottom of the form certifying you were here for the entire live or recorded delivery. As long as you check that box, as soon as you hit the submit button, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records. If you join together in a conference room as a group, each person can fill out that feedback form on their own, even if they didn't register individually. So I would ask whoever set up the conference room and did register, please copy and share that seminar feedback form link with your colleagues so that they can share their thoughts and get their own certificate. Today's session was recorded, just like the others in the RCRA Expert Series, and you'll automatically get an email from me as soon as that archive is available. And so with that, we'll go ahead and close out our reminder.